You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Well, the president, when he was told he'd won the Nobel Peace Prize, said humbly he possibly didn't deserve it, but he went to Oslo today and accepted that prize and delivered a lecture, a speech to 1,000 people at Oslo City Hall, a speech that in some parts sounded like an address that could have been given by almost any U.S. president.
I, like any head of state, reserve the right to act unilaterally, if necessary, to defend my nation. Nevertheless, I am convinced that adhering to standards, international standards, strengthens those who do, and isolates and weakens those who don't. The world rallied around America after the 9/11 attacks and continues to support our efforts in Afghanistan because of the horror of those senseless attacks and the recognized principle of self-defense.
President Obama speaking in Oslo and accepting the Nobel Peace Prize. But there were many places, and certainly the circumstances of Barack Obama's speech set him apart from other recipients, certainly other American recipients, being involved in two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, a Middle East peace policy that seems stymied at this point. And even though he has pledged to reduce, if not eliminate, nuclear weapons, that process is right now unclear where it goes from here. To react to the speech and to assess whether Barack Obama really deserves this award, or maybe what he needs to do to truly deserve this award, it's something we're asking you this morning at 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Or David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent, who joins us from Washington, D.C. David, good morning.
Good morning.
And James Fallows is still with us, former presidential speechwriter and Atlantic Magazine contributor. He's also on the line from Washington. James, thanks for being with us again.
My pleasure.
So, David Sanger, let's just get right into it. Your reaction to the speech?
You know, I thought it was an interesting effort by the president, and probably a largely successful one, to define something that has been somewhat elusive to us in the past year, which is what exactly is the Obama doctrine and how does it differ from the Bush doctrine? Because one of the things that, of course, has disappointed some of his supporters, particularly on the left side of the Democratic Party, was that they thought that they were electing an anti-war candidate. And of course, as president, he has just accelerated the commitment in Afghanistan, and he has continued a pace, actually increased the pace of things like Predator strikes over the border and against Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. And we heard today his explanation of why. He said outright that he believed that unilateral action was, and unilateral military action was, still often required, and that he would go do it. But you saw the word in that clip you used, John. He used the word international, which was something that you never heard from President Bush, who always reserved the right for the U.S. to act regardless of what the international opinion was. And I think that was his effort to shade American policy.
The Bush word would have been U.S. national interest rather than international standards, right? Is your supposition there. Interesting.
Which I don't think Obama would have argued with necessarily, right, in an extreme case, but in cases like this, I think he's found the need, as he said, get the additional power that you get from international approval.
James Fallows, David Sanger there describes a set of explanations of what we might call Barack Obama's predicament right now. He's won the award, but he has many challenges ahead. Did you hear an Obama doctrine in this speech this morning?
I heard it less the Obama doctrine than I did sort of the Obama consciousness. I think that while this was not as sort of spectacular from U.S. standards as his speech in Philadelphia a year and a half ago on race relations, which essentially saved his presidential campaign, I think it was similar to the mindset that we saw in that speech, in his inaugural address, in his speech in Cairo to the Islamic world, in essentially taking two things struck me about it. One is the long view, saying this is a process of years and decades and the rest. And the other is what we used to call a sort of Niebuhrian consciousness. We could eventually call it an Obama consciousness, of recognizing contradictions, recognizing ultimate frailties in the human condition, but nonetheless insisting on steps X and Y and Z. And so I it did seem to me, I'm sure there will be doctrines which flow from this, but I was struck by its by this as being one more sort of chapter in the basic mindset and worldview of Barack Obama as he approaches a range of problems.
David Sanger of the New York Times, there's been much said about how Barack Obama will use the Nobel Peace Prize, whether it will help or hinder him. One of the things that I heard was in many times he seemed to be calling directly to his NATO allies to continue their support of the war in Afghanistan and maybe increase it. At one point he specifically said, in a world in which threats are more diffuse and missions more complex, America cannot act alone.
You know, I think that he was getting at the European and American divide here. I was in Europe a week or so after the award was announced, and on shows like this one and just in conversations with Europeans, I was struck by the number of people who asked me whether the award itself would keep him from escalating in Afghanistan, which was clearly what many Europeans hoped. And you know, I didn't believe it would, and I think one of the reasons that this award is so problematic for him is that it creates a set of expectations abroad that I think he believes he can't meet, and it creates a political problem for him in the United States. I was also struck by the fact that when you think about who the awardees have been by the Nobel Committee in the past few years, many of them appear to reach or be awarded a Nobel Peace Prize for not being George Bush. You know, there was Al Gore got one for his environmental work, Mohammed El-Baradei and the IAEA, which stood up to President Bush during the run-up to the Iraq War, got one for their work, and now this one. And so the committee has sort of gone out of its way to pick people who they thought went opposite the Bush doctrine.
Interesting. Well, you know, that raises, listen to this clip, James Fallows, for a moment, because in some ways maybe he's making the argument here in his speech that he is not going to be guided or dissuaded to move forward by this Peace Prize.
I know that engagement with repressive regimes lacks the satisfying purity of indignation. But I also know that sanctions without outreach, condemnation without discussion, can carry forward only a crippling status quo.
So James Fallows, is there the seed of an Obama doctrine in there, or is he pretty much talking about the status quo of engagement with repressive regimes and talk of sanctions?
I think he was trying to give a sort of larger structure to that that engagement that's been underway for a while. And it's striking to me, following what David was saying, that he didn't mention to my notice either Al Gore or Jimmy Carter. Instead, reached back to previous Nobel laureates who'd been involved in the same sort of work he's trying to talk about, which is the long, slow institution building. So he was looking for a different sort of Nobel Peace Prize heritage.
The references there being the Marshall Plan, right?
Right, exactly.
And the League of Nations, which, of course, was a
failure.
And the
Red Cross with the rules of war, et cetera.
Indeed. Well, lots to talk about. It's interesting. We're going to have to go here. But James Fallows, thanks so much. Former presidential speechwriter and Atlantic Magazine contributor reacting to Barack Obama's Nobel Peace Prize speech. And, of course, our dear friend David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent. Thanks to both of you.